And to get that nice analog, you really needed to have them be overlapping probability distributions. If you had your quantum states as probability distributions over something deeper, but they didn't overlap at all, then you wouldn't be able to have this kind of story. And that's the distinction between what I call the psi-ontic and the psi-epistemic hidden variable models. The psi-epistemic hidden variable models, non-orthogonal quantum states, are represented by overlapping probability distributions. The second example we looked at was the fact that you don't have an exponential divergence of quantum states in the projective Hilbert space. So the inner product between quantum states stays constant. And that's analogous to the fact that there's a notion of distance between probability distributions on a classical phase space, and that distance also stays constant under any evolution, including chaotic dynamics. So the third example has to do with the no-cloning theorem. Did Ben Schumacher talk about the no-cloning theorem?
Yeah.
He did. Okay, so let me briefly review it. The idea is the following. So here's a simple example of cloning. The task would be you have some system. It's been prepared in one of two states, psi1 or psi2. And you're given the system, but you're not told which of these two states it was prepared in. Your task is to take the system, the first system, couple it to another system, which is in some fixed state that you know, let's call it chi, and evolve them in such a way that both systems, at the end of the day, come to be in the quantum state of the first system. But that's a quantum state you don't know. So you want an evolution which, if the state of the first system is psi1, then psi1 tensor chi evolves to psi1 tensor psi1. And if it was psi2, then psi2 tensor chi should evolve to psi2 tensor psi2. That's the challenge for the cloner. Now, can anyone remember why it's not possible in quantum theory? Tibra. Good, because you know then it would be too easy. So I guess it's not a question of do you remember, but maybe can you see what might be a problem with this kind of evolution? Yes.
Make a lot of states that
are
the same, but you
know, good. Yes, that's a very nice argument. We know that if I have psi1 and psi2 that are non-orthogonal, then there's no measurement that can tell me with certainty which I have. But if I can make an arbitrary number of copies of psi1 and an arbitrary number of copies of psi2, or that is, if I, starting from one copy of a state, I can make an arbitrary number, then I could turn this system into n copies of psi1, and now I have to distinguish n copies of psi1 from n copies of psi2. And as I take the overlap of these guys to the power n, it gets smaller and smaller and closer to zero, and so my probability of discriminating them will eventually become one. So clearly, if quantum mechanics says I can't discriminate them, then I shouldn't be able to copy them either. Another way to see it is that by unitarity, the inner product doesn't change. And so if I look at the inner product of the two possible initial states, psi1 tensor chi and psi2 tensor chi, well, chi overlap with chi is just 1, so it's just psi1 overlap psi2. But if I look at the inner product of the two possible final states, it's this. So now I have a psi1 overlap psi2 and a second one. So I have psi1 overlap psi2 squared. And if the inner product of the possible states before has to equal the inner product of the possible states afterwards, then those two things have to be equal. That's only true if the overlap is 0 or 1. The 0 case corresponds to two orthogonal states. That's the case, so you can clone two orthogonal states. You can also make... You can also distinguish them with certainty. So it's not a problem that you can make arbitrary numbers of copies because you could already discriminate them. The other case is that they're the same state. Well, then you know what the state is. So, of course, you can make as many copies as you want. Okay, so again, if you think that you know the quantum state should be thought of as a state of reality, this is a phenomenon that you have to understand somehow. You know, why is it that I can't make a copy of the state of reality of the system? If you take the view that quantum states are like probability distributions, then what you're copying is not the state of reality of something, its ontic state, but you're copying the applicability of a certain probability distribution. So what you're told is, I give you a system, right? Its physical states are described by Z, and I have some knowledge of it. My knowledge is either described by mu1 or mu2. Equivalently, you could say, look, I've drawn this system from one of two ensembles that are characterized by mu1 or mu2. Doesn't make a difference. So you have the system, and your task now is to couple it to another system whose physical states are described by y in some fixed distribution nu, and evolve them together such that at the end of the day, I would then say, right, my knowledge about y is exactly the same as my knowledge about z. So I, at the end of the day, should describe this pair as mu1 z mu 1 y, if my original knowledge of the first system was mu1, or mu2, if my original knowledge was mu2. So I'm asking you to say, prepare a second system for which I have exactly the same knowledge as the first system I gave you. Is that clear? OK. Now, here's the analog of why it's not possible. So you know, this was surprising to me when I learned it. There is a no-cloning theorem in classical statistical mechanics. So I'm about to tell you what it is. It relies on Liouville's theorem. So again, one way of expressing Liouville's theorem is that the overlap between two probability distributions doesn't change under Hamiltonian evolution. Hamiltonian evolution is the analog of unitary evolution in a classical theory. So I introduced last time this notion of classical fidelity. So the square root of one probability distribution times the square root of another integrated over the space is a measure of how close those two distributions are. It's my classical analog of inner product. So take the two possible initial distributions, mu1 nu and mu2 nu, calculate their classical fidelity. Well, the nus are the same here and here. So the square root nu times square root of nu just gives me a nu. I integrate over y. Nu is a normalized distribution, so I just get 1. So what's left over is just the classical fidelity between mu1 and mu2. If I look at the classical fidelity between the two possible final distributions, mu1, mu1, and mu2, mu2, now I can just, you know, take all the stuff that depends on z in the front and all the stuff that depends on y in the back, and I just have this classical fidelity between the two distributions squared. So it looks a lot like this situation, where at the end of the day, I just have a notion of the distance between mu1 and mu2, and this is that distance squared. And Liouville's theorem tells me that those should be the same, the overlap between the initial probability distributions and the overlap between the final distributions cannot change according to Liouville's theorem under Hamiltonian evolution. So if this is equal to its squared, it has to be 0 or 1. And we talked last time about how if this is 0, it means mu1 and mu2 don't overlap at all. And that's exactly the case where you would expect to be able to, you know, well, it's the analog of them being orthogonal, right? So I was talking about how non-orthogonal states correspond to overlapping distributions for a psi epistemic model. If you tell me that mu1 and mu2 don't overlap, then they're like orthogonal quantum states. The other case is where this is 1, in which case mu2 is equal to mu1, and you know exactly what the probability distribution is, so you can prepare another system in that distribution, because there's no uncertainty about what the distribution is. So I should say that this example was told to me by Chris Fuchs many years ago, and for me, that it was very significant. I hadn't realized that you could do this kind of thing classically. And for me, it certainly shook my confidence that quantum states should be thought of as states of reality. Yes?
So in the complicated, what would Z be, for example, momentum and position? Or
yeah, it could be a phase space.
Right.
Yep. Questions about this? Yes, Mike.
So how do you define fidelity?
Let me do it on the board. So the fidelity between a probability distribution P1 of Z and a probability distribution P2 of Z is the integral over Z of square root of P1 of Z square root P2 of Z. And so all I'm doing here is plugging in for P1 the mu1 nu, and for P2 the mu2 nu. And as I said last time, you know, if this is, goes between 0 and 1, if P1 and P2 have no overlap, so if these guys are essentially orthogonal in their support, then this fidelity is 0. And if P1 is equal to P2, then the fidelity is 1. If you look at a notion of overlap of mixed states in quantum theory, there's something which reduces to the inner product in the case of pure states, and it's called the quantum fidelity between mixed states. And that's why I call this the classical fidelity, because it's the analog of that quantity. Other questions? Yes?
Can you give a quick example? I know Tiber's asked, but yes. Something classically that demonstrates the Noetherian theorem, like a classical system. What would an example?
So if you take, you know, a single degree of freedom, of some canonical degree of freedom, like a particle's position on a line, then Z could be the phase space for that particle. And I hand you this particle, and I say, OK, I have some knowledge about where it is in its phase space. Now, you've got a particle in your lab, and I say, look, what I want you to do is hand both those particles back to me. And I want it to be, I want you to do an operation and describe the operation to me such that at the end of the day, I'll say, yeah, whatever I knew about the first particle, my knowledge now of the pair of particles is just the product of that distribution times itself. So I basically kind of want to, you know, maybe I don't know everything about the first particle. I'm just telling you, you know, try to make my particular kind of knowledge about this particle also apply to the second particle. You know, maybe because I'm really keen on having this kind of knowledge or whatever. You know, it's sort of an artificial thing. You know, why would I want that? But it's in this analogy between quantum states and probability distributions, it is the strict analog of what we're asking for here. Yes, Deborah. That's right. The applicability of a particular state of knowledge. That's right. And that's why, I mean, the intuition, most people have an intuition that you can clone classically because you think that the thing that is to be cloned is the physical state. So, you know, if I have a system, it's prepared in some physical state, I pass it to you, you can measure its physical state and then prepare a second system in that same physical state, and you've cloned it. So that's why if quantum states are physical states, this seems like a very odd phenomenon. Whereas if you make the comparison differently, then you find that there is already an instance of this phenomena in the classical world. Good. Just as a tangent, there's also something called... I'm not going to go into it. Yes?
So you're arguing that it makes more sense to think of the no-cloning theorem as not being able to clone information about the state rather than the state itself?
Well, maybe put in some adjectives there. Are you talking about ontic states or epistemic states?
Ontic states, I think.
Ontic states. So roughly speaking, the statement here is that if you think that quantum states are epistemic states, then an analogy with classical theories suggests that, you know, you should anticipate that cloning is not possible. If you think of quantum states as ontic states, then your analogy with classical theory might have led you to expect that cloning was possible. So this is kind of an argument that doesn't rely on the nature of the mathematical formalism. It's more, you know, what should you expect given a particular view of what the quantum state is describing? Yes.
So this may or may not be interesting. But Ben Schumacher's way of proving the no-cloning theorem was as a corollary of the information isolation theorem.
Oh, yeah.
Which is something that he proves in his textbook. So.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I'll have to take a look at that. Okay. Let's move on to the fourth and final example I'll look at, which is an effect described by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. So this is, you know, did you want to talk about the last slide?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So
sure.
If we have a psionic view.
Yes.
Like classically, we cannot say nothing about the non-polygonic theorem.
You have trouble making a good classical analog to it. I mean, it does. I'm not saying this rules out psionic approaches. All I'm saying is that, you know, if you believe in a psionic hidden variable model, then you're going to have to tell me some sort of story as to why I can't clone quantum states. You need some picture of reality such that that comes out. And as we'll see next week in, say, Bohmian mechanics, there is a story about why that doesn't come out. Now, you could argue about sort of, you know, which story is a better story. What I'm trying to do here is say, look, this psi epistemic approach, one of the things that it has going for it is that making sense of these, it seems particularly easy to make sense of these kinds of phenomena. I mean, it seems rather intuitive. The problem that the psi epistemic approaches are going to have is that so far we don't have any interpretation of quantum mechanics that really delivers on this, right? So we have no hidden variable model of quantum mechanics that actually reproduces all of its predictions and treats the quantum state as a state of knowledge. So that's why it's sort of an unfinished project. But my goal for the next lecture or so is just to tell you how sort of compelling these sorts of approaches are, to maybe give you a feeling that there's some good reasons why people might explore hidden variable models. Yes?
I still don't see why all these elements should favor the epistemic view. Because, I mean, this, if you try to make a classical analog,
yes?
Sure, the scientific doesn't have a classical analog.
Yes?
Quantum theory, it is by definition something that is not classical. So I don't know if you want to share this or not, but I mean, I don't feel like
I need to give a classical explanation to quantum mechanics.
That's fine. I mean, you don't have to be moved by these examples. That's okay, you know, that's a prerogative. Maybe just to try to shake your confidence a little bit, to my mind, you know, that there is a certain criteria when we do science of, you know, consilience, that things should hang together well. So on that grounds, you might say if you can make an analogy between quantum and classical that's, you know, very powerful according to one approach, and very weak according to another, then maybe that's evidence in favor of the first approach. It's not conclusive, I agree, and I'm not arguing that this shows that we must interpret the quantum state this way. It's just meant to be a plausibility argument. Take it or leave it.
Because in another way, we can say that the Liouville theorem is a consequence of the quantum no-cloning theorem, in some sense. If we turn it the other way around. And
so if you say, suppose we think of classical theories emerging from quantum theory.
Yeah.
Then classical probability distributions, usually that way of doing it, we think of classical probability distributions as particular mixed quantum states, the ones that have diagonal density operators. And they're all diagonal in some fixed spaces. So telling me about the no-cloning theorem doesn't right away imply anything about diagonal density operators. But there are some results in quantum theory about, you know, when is it that you can clone diagonal density operators. So you could hope to use those sorts of results to constrain the classical case. Your broader point is that essentially, you know, maybe we shouldn't be moved by analogies between quantum theory and classical theory, because the appropriate thing is to think of classical theory as a particular case of quantum theory. The quantum theory is going to define the correct ontology, and then we're going to try to understand classical theories emerging from quantum theory.
Yeah, or a particular case, or a completely different theory that is don't have the same properties.
So it wouldn't trouble you if there was no connection between quantum and classical theories, that they make totally different statements about the world, and we just had to live with two different theories?
Classical theory must emerge from
okay. All right. It's a valid perspective. All right. Let me move on to the next example. So this is, as I said, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect, which is very famous and which the foundations talk about a lot. I'm not going to give you the formulation that was found in the EPR paper, but kind of more modern version of it involving two spin systems. So let me first tell you what is surprising about this effect if you take the view that the quantum state describes reality. So here in some, so this is a space-time diagram. Time is here, space is here. I have a pair of particles prepared in this state psi. So this is a pair of spin a half particles. And then they're separated and sent off to Alice, who's over here, and Bob, who's over here. And then Alice and Bob are going to do, Alice is going to do a measurement. And that measurement is going to be space-like separated from, you know, whatever Bob does in his lab. Like, he might do a measurement of the system. So here's what the collapse, or just, you know, the mathematical formalism of quantum theory, even if you're an operationalist, it says the following, that if Alice chooses to measure in the z-spin basis, okay, so she'll get plus z or minus z with probabilities half each. But furthermore, she'll update her description of Bob's system to the plus z state or the minus z state corresponding to which outcome she got. So effectively, by doing a local measurement, she's collapsing the total quantum state to this term or this term. Okay, so that's similar to a homework assignment you have. If she measures instead the x-spin basis, then it turns out you can rewrite this same quantum state as plus x, plus minus x, minus x. It's just another way of representing the same quantum state. And so you can easily prove that if she measures the plus x state on her half, then she collapses Bob's system to the plus x. And if she measures minus x on her half, then she collapses Bob's system to minus x. So what's odd here is that if you take a psiontic view, these four quantum states describe four different possible realities for the state of Bob's system. So the claim is that, you know, these are four different ways that Bob's system could be. And yet, Alice is deciding whether it's going to be one of these two possibilities or one of these two possibilities based on a choice she makes in her lab, which is space-like separated from Bob's system. So Einstein's complaint was that this is a kind of action at a distance. If you believe that these describe states of reality, then you're influencing what kind of reality can pertain at B by a choice you make at A. That influence doesn't allow you to signal, but Einstein thought it's, you know, still the kind, you know, not the kind of thing we would want in a local theory. Okay, now here's how you'd interpret the same experiment if you take the view that quantum states are really probability distributions over something deeper. So suppose that Bob's system is described by a variable lambda, which takes its value somewhere between 0 and L. And suppose that the initial, and Alice's system is exactly the same, and the initial entangled state they prepare is just a correlation between the state, the ontic state of Alice's system and the ontic state of Bob's system. So perfect correlation. If Alice's system has value, you know, lambda equal to L over 2, then Bob's system also has lambda prime equal to L over 2. So the marginal on Bob's system to start off with, you know, what does Alice know about Bob's system in the beginning? Well, nothing at all. It's just a flat distribution. But if she comes along to her system and asks the question, her system is called lambda prime here, asks the question, you know, is it in the first half of that state space between 0 and L over 2, or is it in the second half? And suppose she finds that it's in the first half. Well, because she knows that it's perfectly correlated with Bob's system, she'll update her information about Bob's system. She'll say, now I know Bob's system is in the first half of the state space as well. So she'll update her description of Bob's system to this distribution. Whereas if she finds it between L over 2 and L, then she'll update to this distribution here. And those two things will occur with probability of half. Similarly, if she did a different measurement, which is just ask if it's between L over 4 and 3L over 4, or outside that region, then she'll update her description of Bob's system according to whatever outcome she gets. And so the point is that here, there's no non-local action. Bob's system starts out in some state lambda, and after Alice does her measurement, it stays in that state lambda. But Alice's information about what the state of Bob's system is could be updated in one of two ways. She might choose to update it in this way to sort of be clear on whether it's in the first half or the second half, or updated in this way to be clear on whether it's in the middle or on the edges. But all along, nothing will have happened to the physical state of Bob's system. Is that clear? Yes.
There's something else we can
do. Okay.
Swiss like separated the measurement devices that are measuring the same system?
No, there are two systems. One spin a half goes to Alice, one spin a half goes to Bob. They're prepared in an entangled state. Einstein's arguing that let's interpret that entangled state as just a statement about what we know about those two systems. In particular, let's assume that it means that we know their physical states are exactly the same. So if I learn anything about the physical state of this guy, I can infer the same conclusions about the physical state of that guy. Because ahead of time, I know that they're in the same physical state. I don't know which physical state they're in, but I know that they're the same. And so if I update my information in one of two ways over here, then that leads me to update my information about the distance system in one of two different ways. And so Einstein's arguing that that's what's going on in the quantum experiment. These two different kinds of collapses are just two ways of updating your information about the distance system. They're not a change to the physical state of that distance system. Good. All right, well, we'll come back to this again. All right, so those are my four examples to, I guess, motivate what we're going to do next. And so what I'm going to do next, actually, is I'm going to indulge myself and tell you a bit about my own research. And the idea here is that I want to try to get as close to quantum mechanics as possible using this idea that the world is just classical with one extra ingredient, which is that there's a constraint on how much you can know. There's a fundamental limitation on the amount of information you can obtain about the classical states of systems. And so I want to show you that implementing that constraint gets you very close to quantum theory. It gets you a theory that is actually a subset of real quantum theory. It doesn't get you all the way. But it does manage to make a lot of quantum phenomena appear quite natural in the kinds of ways that these four examples have shown. Right, so let me tell you about it. So what is Liouville mechanics? So Liouville mechanics is the name that's sometimes given to the theory of statistical distributions for classical particle mechanics. So classical particle mechanics is just Newtonian mechanics. It's a description of how the physical states of particles will evolve. Liouville mechanics is a theory that tells you if your knowledge about the particle is this distribution, then here's how your knowledge will evolve over time under Hamiltonian evolution. And it'll also tell you things like if you do a measurement so that you update your knowledge, how should that distribution change over time? So that's where I'm starting with, you know, a theory of probability distributions over phase space. And now I want to apply an epistemic restriction, a limitation on how much you can know about that physical state. And so the question is, you know, what kind of restriction should I apply? And what we found is that you can do pretty well by just using something like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So quantum mechanics has an uncertainty principle. As you'll see in tutorial today, rather than taking delta x, delta p, gradient equal to h bar over 2, there's a stronger form of the uncertainty principle, which involves this extra term here, which is a cross-correlation between position and momentum. So let me remind you that the variance in position is just the expectation of x squared minus expectation of x squared. And here, the expectation values are all calculated relative to a quantum state rho by taking the trace of the associated operator. So this is a statement about the probability distributions you would obtain doing measurements of position and momentum. So now I'm going to use that to come up with a restriction on what you can know by just writing down exactly the same uncertainty relation, but now giving a new meaning to delta x and delta p and cxp. The idea is that you can take expectation values of classical variables if you have a distribution. So suppose mu x comma p is my distribution over the phase space. Then for any variable, some function of x and p, I can ask what's the expectation value of that variable given that distribution. So it's not a quantum expectation value. It's a classical probabilistic expectation value. So you could define these expectation values and then define a variance in position. So if you look at this sort of Gaussian distribution, the variance in position is just going to tell me something about its the width of this Gaussian in along the position axis. And the variance in momentum will tell you about the width of this Gaussian along the momentum axis. And the cross-correlation will tell you something about how they're correlated. So you can just you can make this your assumption. You will not allow any distributions that are both narrow in position and narrow in momentum. They're going to have to have they're going to have to cover a certain area in phase space. So we're taking this as a postulate and seeing where we're going with it. I'm happy to talk about why should the world be like that, but I think that's an interesting question. But today I just want to take that as a starting postulate and show where we can go. Okay, so here's the idea. Liouville mechanics with an epistemic restriction is a theory where you assume what I'll call a classical uncertainty principle, which says that the only Liouville distributions that can be prepared are those satisfying this uncertainty relation. And it turns out you also need to say that they have maximal entropy for a given set of second order moments. So this is an extra constraint. You say, well, there's lots of distributions that might have a given set of second order moments, a variance in position and momentum, like a top hat or a Gaussian and so on. And we're just going to consider those that maximize the entropy of that distribution. And it turns out that if you look at all the distributions that have a given set of second order moments, it's the Gaussian distributions that maximize the entropy. So this theory is only going to have Gaussian distributions in it. Okay, so what picture do you get? Well, it says that here are some distributions that are allowed. This one is equal width in position and momentum. It's Gaussian. Here, I can imagine squeezing in the position axis and spreading it out in the momentum axis. That's fine because the area and phase space will be the same. And in fact, I could squeeze infinitely along x and spread it out infinitely along p, and I'll get a distribution where I know x perfectly and I know nothing about p. And so that's going to be the analog in this model of a position eigenstate. So according to this perspective, a position eigenstate is like knowing everything about x and nothing about p. And then similarly, you could get something where you knew everything about momentum and nothing about position. But you can't have a distribution where you know everything about position and momentum. And you can't have some arbitrary non-Gaussian distributions, according to the postulate that defines this theory. You also have now a distinction between pure states of knowledge and mixed states of knowledge. So this is a question that came up last time, I think. So in this theory, if I look at a Gaussian wherein delta x delta p saturates the inequality in the uncertainty principle, that's a pure state. That's pure in the sense that if you look at the convex set of probability distributions that are allowed in this theory, you'll find that there are some extremal elements. There are some probability distributions that can't be written as mixtures of other probability distributions. And those are going to be the ones that are pure. So a Gaussian that saturates the uncertainty relation, this infinitely squeezed state along momentum is another example. So things like the position, the analogs of the position and momentum eigenstates are pure states in this model. But I can also have states of knowledge where less is known. So I could have a delta x and a delta p that are wider. They don't saturate that uncertainty relation. Or I could have a distribution that's totally uniform over the whole space. And I can think of this now as a mixture, a uniform mixture of all these different states of well-known momentum, mixed over all momenta. I think I have that on the next slide. Right. I can think of it as a uniform mixture of all the well-known momenta states, or equivalently as a uniform mixture of all the well-known position states. So these are two different decompositions of one mixed state into two sets of pure states. So that's, again, one of the nice things about having a psi epistemic approach is that there's a natural way of understanding the multiplicity of convex decompositions of mixed states that we see in quantum theory. It says, well, if pure states aren't themselves states of reality, if they're themselves states of knowledge, then I could imagine decomposing a mixed state in many different ways. Okay, I need to tell you something about how to generalize this to more than one particle. Maybe I should pause. Are there questions so far about the one particle example? Yes?
I know what one particle is, but how does one do it on a qubit?
I think I'll cover that either at the end of today or tomorrow. Yeah, we'll consider the cubic case. Okay, so other questions about the one particle case? All right, what can we say about multiple particles? So for this, you need to know something that you don't find in the textbook. It's a generalization of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to multiple particles. This will also be in tutorial today. I think this is a very nice result. Here's an expression of an uncertainty principle. Let me tell you what it means. Gamma of rho is what's called the covariance matrix. So it's a matrix that's 2n by 2n. So imagine you have n canonical degrees of freedom. So you could think of that as, say, you know, n particles each living in a one-dimensional space. It's 2n because you have a position and a momentum for each particle. Along the diagonal, you have the variance in position for the first particle, the variance in momentum for the first particle, variance in position for the second particle, variance in momentum for the second particle, and so on. And on the off diagonals, you have cross correlations between the position of the first particle, the momentum of the first particle, the position of the first particle, the momentum of the second, and so on. Okay? So basically, this encodes information about the correlations between any two canonical variables for your n canonical systems. This object here is also a 2n by 2n matrix. It's called the symplectic form. So it's zeros everywhere off of this block diagonal, and it has this simple form on the block diagonal. So you might remember this from classical mechanics. This comes up a lot in analytic mechanics. So the equation now is a matrix inequality. So on the left-hand side, you have a complex 2n by 2n matrix, and you're saying it should be positive. Now, the interpretation of a matrix inequality is just just as we had positive operators, density operators are positive operators. I can say for an operator on any vector space, it's positive if I take any vector y on that space, and the inner product, the expectation value of A with respect to that vector y, is positive for all y. So that's the definition of positivity. This is just what I mean by saying A is greater or equal to 0. So really, this is encoding a whole bunch of inequalities, you know, one for every vector you can write down. That's not very convenient to work with, an infinite set of inequalities. A better way to think about it is that this implies that all the eigenvalues of this matrix here are positive. And so you now have a finite set of inequalities. So just think of this as encoding a finite number of inequalities. Diagonalize this matrix. You'll get a bunch of expressions that involve these variances and cross correlations and then involve h bar. And each one of those expressions is going to have to be positive. So let's consider an example. If you have a single particle in one dimension, then it's just a 2 by 2 matrix, the covariance matrix. And the symplectic form is just this first block here. So this is your inequality. So you could calculate the eigenvalues of, so I'm just adding these two matrices up here. Okay, so I just get this adjustment on the off diagonal. And then I could calculate the eigenvalues of this. But it turns out that for a 2 by 2 matrix, it's sufficient to just set the determinant positive. That's equivalent to setting the eigenvalues positive. And if I look at the determinant of this guy, I get delta squared x delta p squared minus the cross correlation squared greater than or equal to h bar over 2 squared. That's just the slightly generalized form of the Heisenberg uncertainty relation I told you before. So you should be convinced that at least for the case of one particle, this equation does encode the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. And what you'll show in tutorial today, you'll actually derive that this equation follows from the canonical commutation relations for n systems. Okay, so the assumption now I'm going to make in this theory as a postulate is that this uncertainty principle has to hold for n canonical degrees of freedom. So again, I can define a covariance matrix, but now the covariance matrix is defined not for a quantum state, but for some distribution over the phase space of all n particles. And so I just define each of these expectation values in these quantities in terms of that distribution. And I demand that this this holds. So the classical uncertainty principle is demanding that this hold for the distributions. And again, I'm going to ask that they be maximal entropy, so to pick out particular distributions that have those second order moments. And once again, if you ask which distributions maximize the entropy subject to this constraint, you find that it is the multivariate Gaussians. So it's not important to understand this equation, but essentially this is a way of expressing a Gaussian for n canonical degrees of freedom. Instead of having a variance up in the exponent, you have the covariance matrix appearing. So it's hard to picture, but you know, you can have states that are squeezed along any direction in the phase space. They can have correlations between the canonical variables of different degrees of freedom. So the point is that there's a lot of distributions in this set, and they describe, you know, a lot of interesting scenarios. Let me just point out a couple of distributions you can have for 2 degrees of freedom. So one kind of distribution would just be a product distribution. It would say your knowledge about particle 1 is uncorrelated, or particle 1 is uncorrelated to particle 2. Learning something about particle 1 teaches you nothing about particle 2. You can also have correlated distributions. So here's one. It's a distribution wherein you don't know anything about the position of particle 1 or the momentum of particle 1. But you do know that whatever the position of particle 1 is, particle 2 has exactly the same position. That's this delta function here. And whatever the momentum of particle 1 is, particle 2 has the negative of that momentum. And that's the second delta function. This is the analog of the entangled state that was used in the original paper by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, wherein the positions were correlated and the momenta were anticorrelated. So turns out this is a valid quantum state for 2 particles. And this is the analog of that state. So it's going to play the role of the maximally entangled state in this theory. Yes, Deborah?
Does this violate the
function? It doesn't, no. So this theory by construction is going to be local. It's going to satisfy Bell inequalities. You can now ask the following question. All I've done thus far is characterize, according to my postulate, what are the appropriate distribution, what are the distributions, the kinds of states of knowledge you can have about any number of canonical degrees of freedom. But you can also ask, what are the dynamics that are allowed? And so the principle I'm going to apply here is that I just allow any valid classical dynamics as long as it doesn't violate my starting postulate, which is that you can never know too much about the physical state of the system. So it turns out that the set of deterministic transformations which don't violate the postulate are the canonical transformations that have Hamiltonians that are quadratic in the position and the momentum. And that's because if I want the uncertainty principle to be preserved, if I want to start with a distribution that has the correct second order moments and evolve to one that has second order moments that don't violate the uncertainty principle, then only canonical transformations will do that. And if I want to preserve Gaussianity, because I have this maximum entropy postulate, then I can't go beyond quadratic Hamiltonians, because anything higher than quadratic will take a Gaussian distribution to a non-Gaussian distribution. So it leaves you with a subset of all the Hamiltonians. So you could shift in your phase space, you can rotate in phase space, you can squeeze in phase space. It's still an interesting subset. It's actually, if you go into a quantum optics lab, you can describe the state of light in terms of harmonic oscillators. And the kinds of transformations they do are all of this sort. They're rotating in phase space, shifting, squeezing. So this captures all the kinds of experiments that you'll find in linear optics. So it's a large set. The next question you can ask is, well, what are the measurements that are going to be allowed according to the postulate? And so now we have to say, well, what are the indicator functions in this theory? So indicator functions are, remember, functions that tell you the probability of outcome k given that the physical state is described by x and p. I imagine to understand what kind of constraints I can get on these, imagine the following scenario. You have a pair of systems here, 1 and 2. You have some knowledge about them. They're correlated. And then you come along to system 1 and you measure it. this is going to impose constraints on the kinds of measurements you can do. So here's an obvious one. Suppose you came along to system one and you measured its position and momentum perfectly. And suppose that your initial knowledge was this EPR kind of knowledge, where the positions of the two particles are perfectly correlated and the momenta are perfectly anti-correlated. If you updated your knowledge about the first guy so that you have no uncertainty anymore about position momentum, then you would update your knowledge about the second guy in the same way. And so even if this measurement here would disturb the position of the momentum, even if I totally re-randomized them as a result of this measurement, this distance system, which is just doing its own thing, there's no disturbance acting on it, I would have too much information about it at the end of the day. It would violate the uncertainty principle. So that tells you you're going to have to constrain the kind, how much information you get about position and momentum in this theory. So in particular, if you consider the case where the original distribution is this EPR one, perfect correlation, perfect anticorrelation, and you ask, how am I going to update my knowledge about the second system given that I've just done a measurement and gotten an outcome associated with this indicator function? Well, if you just do this integral, so this is the expression for how I should update my knowledge, because I'm just using Bayesian probability theory here. This is the probability of passing the test given x1 and x and p1. This is the overall probability of x1, x2, p1, and p2. So if I integrate over x1 and p1, I just get the marginal probability for x2 and p2. So if I do this integral, I use the delta functions, I just get this. It's the same function, but I've changed the sign of p2. And so what it says is that the only valid indicator functions are those which are valid distributions under a change in the sign of momentum. So that constraint I showed earlier on, you know, what are the valid distributions, that constraint must also apply to the indicator functions modulo this change in the sign of momentum. So intuitively, what it tells you is that you can only find out about position momentum in the same sorts of ways that you can prepare position momentum. So you know, you could probe position momentum in a kind of coherent state sort of way. You know, your indicator function would have a certain spread in position, a certain spread in momentum. I think I have a picture of it like this, right? So I could carve up the space into a bunch of Gaussians that have equal width in x and p if I want. And this would be basically like a fuzzy measurement of position and momentum simultaneously. I won't find out exactly what they are, but I'll be able to localize, roughly speaking, what the position and momentum were. Or if I want, I can use a set of indicator functions, each of which looks like one of those probability distributions that was infinitely squeezed along one direction. So this set of indicator functions is a measurement of position. It just allows me to determine what the original position of the particle was. This is a measurement of momentum. But you can't do any measurement that tells you both with arbitrary position, and you can't do some arbitrary measurement. Okay, so now something a little bit more interesting, which is what's the analog of collapse? So this has come up previously, that it would seem that in these kinds of approaches, the collapse postulate of quantum mechanics should emerge as something natural. So how's it going to work? Well, suppose we do a measurement of position, and suppose we prepare the system ahead of time in one of these states of knowledge where momentum is perfectly known and position is perfectly unknown. So I measure position, and I'm going to get some random outcome now because I have no prior knowledge about what position is. Now, the usual way of updating your probabilities is, well, you knew what the momentum was, you just learned what the position was, so now at the end, you're going to know both position and momentum. But if this were the way that you update probability distributions, at the end of the day, you'd have a violation of the classical uncertainty principle. You'd know too much about position and momentum. So instead, what you have to assume is that at the end of the measurement, it must be that you prepare this kind of distribution. So you got a particular position outcome. The only distribution, valid distribution, that has a well-defined position is one of these guys, where you know nothing about momentum. So what you'd really like is that the distribution you should use after the measurement is exactly this. And you can ensure that that happens, that this is the final distribution, by imagining that the measurement happens in two steps, right? First, you update your information. But second, as a result of having performed the measurement, you cause an unknown shift in the momentum of the particle. So you imagine that the measurement necessarily randomizes the momentum of the particle. So collapse in this approach is a Bayesian updating of your information together with a uniformly random mixture of translations over momentum. And if you do that, you'll get this uniform distribution over momentum. So what I'm arguing here is that this kind of disturbance has to be posited in this theory in order to be able to preserve that postulate we started with. So the game here is imagine a classical world where there's a constraint on how much you know. What would that world have to be like? So this just says, well, if you're going to have that constraint consistently applied, the world is going to have to be the kind of place where when you measure position, you create an unknown disturbance in momentum. Otherwise, the postulate would be violated. Yes? Yes. The next slide will answer your question, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
But the thing with that theory is you cannot really, you see this as a probability distribution, but you cannot specify that, you cannot say that this state has a particular position and momentum and you don't know it.
Yep.
You must say that this is a distribution. Otherwise, you violate those inequalities and stuff like that.
I didn't catch that last bit. So. Otherwise, you violate Bell inequalities.
Yeah, you should.
The
if you say there's a
yes.
defined
yes.
momentum and position and stuff
yes.
like that you cannot know.
Oh, I see. You're saying if you could know it, then I'd say I wouldn't have said violate Bell inequality, but then you would say violate the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. So we have good experimental evidence for the Heisenberg uncertainty relation.
Yeah, but yeah? I mean, if we say that this is a probability distribution,
yes,
then we cannot say that this state as a particular, that this particle as a particular state that we cannot know.
Why not?
Because otherwise we violate the Bell's inequalities, and just from a theoretical perspective, you cannot say that.
I don't think that inference is true. To say that you're saying. If you were to claim that there really was a well-defined position of momentum, it would imply that you could violate a Bell inequality.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case. I mean, maybe you need to tell me more details about how this inference goes. But if there's a fundamental limitation on what you can know, then the fact that there's a well-defined position of momentum shouldn't influence the statistics of experiments you get, right? So what I predict for statistics will depend on, what I know, the original distribution, not necessarily on what's going on underneath. The particular outcome will depend on there being a well-defined position of momentum. Maybe you should tell me about it later, because I don't really know what you have in mind. Other questions? Okay, so this is a derivation of a model of collapse or an analog of collapse in this theory, just starting from the assumption that we need to maintain our postulate. But suppose you wanted to do it differently. Should I say this? Yeah, let me say this and then I'll move on in one slide to let me just make sure. Yeah. Okay. So one consequence of this is that you'll have non-commutativity of position momentum measurements. So this is something we see in quantum mechanics. How does it appear in this theory? Well, suppose you prepare a state of well-known position, and then you measure position followed by a measurement of momentum. In that case, you'll just confirm whatever the position was here, and then you'll get a random outcome for momentum. If you first measure momentum and then position, the act of measuring momentum is going to randomize the position of the particle so that the second measurement is now going to give you a random outcome. So if you think about the outcomes for the position measurements, in the first case, I get a well-defined outcome. In the second case, the position measurement gives me a random outcome. So clearly, the statistics of outcomes of the position measurement have depended on whether it came first or second. So that's just familiar from quantum theory. Measurements of momentum, randomized position. So the analog of the collapse postulate that I just described to you explains this by saying that there's this physical disturbance as a result of doing the momentum measurement. Okay, let me get back to the point I was preparing to say, which is that we can also understand this disturbance by analyzing the measurement not as some external intervention, but as a coupling between my physical system and some second system. So I think this is what you're asking about. So this is a lot like von Neumann's trick, where you say, well, rather than just treating the apparatus by, you know, our Hermitian operator, let's actually give it a Hilbert space and think about a unitary coupling between my system and my apparatus, or some probe system in my apparatus, and then do a measurement on the apparatus itself. So it's the same sort of trick here. I say, rather than just saying I've got a measurement of position on this particle, let me imagine that inside that measurement device there's a probe system, a particle here. And the way a position measurement works is that I'm going to couple the system to the probe according to this kind of interaction Hamiltonian. So this is the position of the system, and this is the momentum of the probe or apparatus. And what this means, because momentum is the generator of shifts, this interaction Hamiltonian will shift the position of the probe proportional to what the position of the system was. We're doing classical theories here. Remember that. There's nothing quantum. I'm just describing what a classical interaction Hamiltonian will do. So I'm setting it up so that this probe is going to be displaced by an amount that depends on the position of the system. And then I'm going to measure the position of the probe. That's how my measurement of position is going to proceed. If I want it to be an accurate measurement, then it had better be that I have some knowledge about the probe's position. If I knew nothing about the probe's position, then I wouldn't know how much it had shifted by, right? You know, I know nothing about where it started, so I might measure where it ended up, but I can't figure out how much it shifted by. So I have to prepare the probe in a state of well-defined position, so ideally infinitely squeezed along position. And so I know nothing about the probe's momentum in this theory, because the probe system is also going to obey the uncertainty relation. My postulate was that every system has to obey this restriction, that you can't know too much about it. Okay, so now here's the punchline. If you have this interaction Hamiltonian between a system and a probe, then you know, you've designed it so that the final position of the apparatus reflects the initial position of the system, because P generates shifts in the apparatus, in the position of the apparatus. But by symmetry, X is the generator of shifts in momentum. So this coupling also has a back action from the apparatus onto the system. It's just, you know, a Newtonian action-reaction. And the final momentum of the system reflects the initial momentum of the apparatus, because this term shifts the momentum of the system by an amount that's proportional to the momentum of the apparatus. And now if you ask, so what do I know about the final momentum of the system? Well, what do I know about the initial momentum of the apparatus? I knew nothing. I had to know nothing about the initial momentum of the apparatus, because that was the only way I could know its position. And so I know nothing about the initial momentum of the apparatus, and that implies that I know nothing about the final momentum of the system. So I've thereby derived the fact that any good measurement of position done in this way will have to create this shift in the momentum of the system, which is totally unknown to you. And that's exactly what we had back here. That you'd be left in a completely uniform distribution over momentum. And so you can run this argument by then, you know, analyzing this measurement as a physical dynamics, and nothing changes. I can move that cut between what I'm treating internally and what I'm treating externally anywhere I like, and I get consistent predictions, just as in von Neumann's argument. Questions?
When you use in quantum mechanics the path integral method, mm-hmm. we assign Gaussian random variable to particle of field. How is that different from this one view?
I don't know. I personally tried to understand the predictions of the path integral or the path integral method for calculating probabilities in this sort of language, and I haven't yet succeeded. So I'm not sure I can really answer that question. But I think it's worth thinking about. All right, let me just make a couple other points and then stop. In this model, you have a very nice analog of the original EPR effects. So the original EPR effect was two particles now prepared in this entangled state where position is correlated and momentum is anticorrelated. And then you imagine measuring either position or momentum on the first particle and thereby learning what the position or momentum of the second particle would be. So you could again say if these things are distributions, then the distribution associated with that original state is this one here. Perfect correlation in position, perfect anticorrelation in momentum. Originally, you know nothing about the position momentum of the second particle. But if Alice measures position on the first system, she learns what the position of the second system is. So she updates to something that looks like a position eigenstate. If she measures momentum, she updates to something that's like a momentum eigenstate. Nothing has changed of the reality of that second system. All along, it had a well-defined position of momentum. But originally, Alice knew nothing about it. And then she can either choose to learn about what its position was, or she can choose to learn about what its momentum was. The postulativist theory says she can't find out both. She has to make a choice. But nothing of the reality of the distance system has changed. Only her information about it has changed. Okay, so the last thing I'll say is that you can then prove that this theory I've just described to you, remember, it didn't use the formalism of quantum mechanics at all. It started with classical particle mechanics. It then applied an uncertainty principle. That uncertainty principle was inspired by quantum theory, and it had h-bar in it. But the status of h-bar was just to quantify how much uncertainty in position and momentum you could have. So it's just a classical theory with a constraint on how much you can know. And you got a lot of stuff that looked like quantum mechanics out of it. A more rigorous statement you can make is that you can reproduce a particular representation of quantum mechanics for a certain subset of quantum states and quantum measurements and quantum transformations. So to tell you that, I need to tell you about the Wigner representation. And you're also going to be looking at this in today's tutorial. So first of all, let me introduce the Weyl operators. So these just are operators that shift you in position and momentum. So this is, we're back to quantum mechanics here. These are unitary operators. You can then define a set of operators which are a kind of Fourier transform of the Weyl operators. Deeper? This is well defined. If you wanted to factorize it, you'd have to use the Baker-Hausdorff formula. But that extra term is just going to involve a commutation of x and p, which is just going to be a phase factor. So if you're applying it to density operators, you have a u and a u dagger, and the phase factors are going to cancel. So actually, this is kind of nice that when you're applying things to density operators, shifts and boosts commute. It's only when you're applying them on vectors in Hilbert space that you get a phase factor when you change the order of shifts and boosts. That's just an aside. So anyways, you can define these operators, which are now labeled by position and momentum. They're the Fourier transform, or this is called the symplectic Fourier transform. It's not important. They're a particular function of these guys. And what you can show is that these form a basis for the operator space. So any operator for the particle can be written as a linear sum of these kinds of operators. And so in particular, it means that if I take the trace of a density operator with A for every value of x and p, that information allows me to reconstruct rho. So that's a perfectly good representation of rho. Because trace of rho times A, that's the inner product on the operator space. And if I take the inner product of something with a complete basis, then it's a complete characterization. So this function here, which is a function on phase space, is a way of representing a density operator. It's called the Wigner representation of that density operator. You can also represent any element of a POVM by its Wigner representation in the same way. And what you can prove is that if you just multiply those Wigner representations and integrate, you get the Born rule, trace of rho times that effect. So you can reproduce your statistics in the Wigner representation by taking these kinds of overlaps. And you can also generalize this to more than one system by just writing down the tensor product of these point operators for each system. Okay, so here's the point that let me go back again. If these functions are positive, then I can understand this as a probability distribution over X and P, and I can understand this as the conditional probability that you'll get outcome E when the system is at X and P. And so I can think of this in a totally classical probabilistic way. And so if my states and my measurements have positive Wigner representations, then I can interpret them in a hidden variable type of approach. And what you can show is that for a certain class of quantum states, the Wigner representation is positive. And it's basically the states that have Gaussian Wigner representations. They're the only ones that are positive. All the other quantum states will have negative Wigner representation, or their Wigner function will go negative somewhere. Anyways, and then you can show that the Wigner representation satisfies the classical uncertainty principle. So if it's positive, then it satisfies our constraint. And I'm just going to rush through the last couple of steps. You can show that there's a set of measurements and a set of transformations that preserve the Gaussianity of the quantum state. And so you can allow those. Their representations are also as conditional probabilities. And so what you can ultimately prove is that this theory I talked to you about today, the Liouville mechanics with an epistemic restriction, is completely equivalent with respect to the predictions it makes as Gaussian quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics where the only states you prepare are these Gaussian states, the only measurements and transformations you do are these Gaussian measurements and transformations. So what it says is that there's this part of quantum mechanics that admits of this very simple hidden variable model, which is kind of intuitive, sounds a little bit like what Heisenberg described. There's a well-defined position momentum, you just don't know what they are. But you can't do it for the whole of quantum mechanics. Yes? There are entangled states among this set of Gaussian states. So the original EPR state is an example of an entangled state, which shows up here. The way it's understood is it's just a very strong correlation between the properties of those particles. Now, what we'll get to eventually is the rest of the quantum formalism includes some stuff that yields Bell's theorem and the Cauchy spectra theorem and stuff that you can't ever hope to explain in precisely this kind of way, with local hidden variables. But that's a subject for another day. So I'm going to stop there. And if you want to go, you can go, but I can ask and still take questions.
Just before you discuss, the tutorial today will be at 2 o'clock, so be back here. The tutorials will be this one and the seminar one for this.
Yes?
The nature of this uncertainty postulate is different from just an experimental insertion, right? Because just do kind of postulate, because you have to observe it, you can do apparatus that is better and better, so that you have to disturb less and less. I think we want to measure to actually extract information. So when you measure the arbitrary, we will use the uncertainty that we get for both measurements.
Yeah, so this is a question about, you know, why should we assume this postulate that I assumed? Can we motivate it somehow? And your question is basically saying, could we motivate it just as a practical constraint that, you know, it's difficult to do any better? I don't think that's going to work. Its status here is more as a fundamental constraint. Like, you know, even in principle, no matter how good of an experimentalist you are, the assumption is you can't get more knowledge than this. So I haven't answered the question of, you know, why would the world be like that? I mean, the truth is that this is a toy. It's a toy model. It's, you know, it doesn't describe the world we see because it doesn't reproduce all of quantum mechanics. So to some extent, you know, perhaps it's not too worthwhile to spend a lot of time trying to motivate this starting postulate, because at the end of the day, this is not a postulate that gets you the full theory. But if you start thinking about, you know, what kinds of ways could the world be such that we would never know everything about it, it might help you ultimately get a proper axiomatization. So roughly speaking, you can imagine, you know, any system in the world that can know things about other systems around it, it has to interact with them. And there's always an action-reaction principle at play. So maybe you can try to motivate the limitation on how much you know based on the fact that every observer is a physical system. And as soon as they try to find out about something, which means that the initial state, say the initial position of that thing, is meant to change some degree of freedom in their memory device. Well, there's a back action, which means that the initial state of their memory device is going to influence some property of that system. And so if they don't have any perfect knowledge of their own memory device, then it's unavoidable that they'll cause unknown disturbances. So you could try to go down that road for trying to motivate the postulate. Yes? Instead, sorry, I messed that last bit.
Instead of a new theory, I mean, it's kind of like the same theory, but with a different interpretation.
What it's generated is an interpretation of some part of quantum mechanics. So if I confine my attention to Gaussian quantum states and Gaussian measurements and Gaussian transformations, and it turns out that there's some experiments that are confined to that set. So I was saying earlier, linear optics. As long as you only do homodyne measurements, and you have phase shifters and squeezers in your apparatus and parametric down conversion. There's a whole set of things you can do in the lab. As long as you confine your attention to those, they fall within this class. And so for those experiments, I do have an interpretation. If I want, I can say, I will interpret each of those quantum states as a probability distribution over phase space, each of the measurements as conditional probabilities on that phase space. Transformations are just, you know, motions through the phase space. And I'll be able to reproduce all those predictions. But it's not an interpretation of the full formalism because, as we'll see, it can't do justice to all quantum states. For example, the Wigner representation will go negative in some areas. Okay, that's it. See you tomorrow.